Good evening. Can you hear me all right back there? Okay, fine. I would like to welcome you to tonight's program. We are pleased to have with us this evening Kubad Talabani, representative of the Kurdish Regional Government to the United States. My name is Frank Rettenberg, and I am a trustee of the World Affairs Council of California. Before we begin, let me say a quick word about the Council. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and informs action. To learn more about how to get involved with the Council and support our mission, please refer to the card on your chair or visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org. If you are unable to attend a program, we offer two excellent ways to stay connected. You may listen to our weekly radio broadcast, It's Your World, on Monday evenings at 8 p.m. on KQED. And on our website, you can find an audio and video archive of all our past programs. Tonight's program is being recorded for radio, and we thank our audio engineer, David Ogilvie. Now, please take a moment to turn off all cell phones and any other electronic devices that might interrupt our program. While you are doing that, I would also like to point out two upcoming programs that might be of interest to you. Next Friday, November 19th, the Council is honored to host the mayor of Haifa, Israel, to discuss why this unique city is a model for coexistence, with Jewish, Muslim, and Christian communities intermingling and living side by side. This event will be held here in the World Affairs Council Auditorium at 1 p.m. Then on Monday, November 22nd, the Council will host Ian Morris, professor of history and classics at Stanford University, to discuss why he believes the West's rule is scheduled to end early in the next century. This event will be held here in the World Affairs Council Auditorium at 6 p.m. Finally, you will see that there are blue question cards that were placed on each of your chairs. Please write down your questions for our speaker and hand them to Council staff members who will be located throughout the room. It is now my pleasure to introduce this evening's distinguished guest. As representative of the Kurdistan Regional Government to the United States, Kubad Talabani works closely with the U.S. government, the media, and research institutions, providing critical analysis and up-to-date information on Iraq and the region of Kurdistan. After Operation Iraqi Freedom, Mr. Talabani served as Senior Foreign Relations Officer for the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, operating mainly out of Baghdad and the Kurdish city of Sulaymaniyah. There he worked closely with the U.S.-led Coalition Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance and was a top liaison to the Coalition Provisional Authority and to U.S. forces in Iraq. He was also a key negotiator in drafting Iraq's first post-Saddam constitution. Mr. Talabani's family has been involved in Kurdish politics for decades. His father, Jalal Talabani, is the President of the Republic of Iraq and Secretary General of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. Here to offer behind-the-scenes insight into the current situation in the Kurdistan region of Iraq, as well as the future role for the U.S. in this region. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Kubad Talabani.
Thank you. Thank you. Frank, if you don't mind, I'll just speak from here. Is that
sure.
Okay?
Whatever. Okay. Whatever
great.
You prefer.
Great. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It really is. I want to thank all of those at the World Affairs Council who invited me here tonight, in particular Carla Thorson and Ned Hawkins, and of course you, Frank, for that introduction, and everyone else who is associated with the event. It's a pleasure to meet you all firsthand. It's great to see the members of the Kurdish community of San Francisco here as well. It's great to see you all participating in an event like this. We should remind the audience, your speaker next week, the mayor of Haifa, that there are in fact Kurds that also live in Haifa. So while there are Arabs and Israelis and Christians there, we throw in some Kurds and it makes it an even more interesting mix of people. But I've had the distinct pleasure of speaking at many World Affairs Councils across the country, and the interest shown by these councils, who play such an important role in connecting Americans with what's going on outside of the United States, gives me a much better feeling about the determination of America to stand by its friends and allies in the world and to be a strong partner for democracy and development in places like Iraq and also the Kurdistan region of Iraq. California conjures up many images for many people. When I think of California, I immediately think of agriculture. I think of the Yosemite. I think of the Pacific. I think of the innovation in technology, in politics, and of course, entertainment. It is a Sam Spade whose office apparently is just two blocks away from here. One said, it is the stuff dreams are made of. So your state is in fact the first state in the United States where women could earn wages higher than men for equivalent work. Your economy is regarded as one of the seventh or eighth largest economies in the world. You've become synonymous with new ideas, with new thinking. California is one of the major reasons why many people actually come to the United States. I'd like to think that we have a little bit of California in us, in Kurdistan, in Iraq. So if you would please, just for a moment, close your eyes and listen to see if this sounds familiar. We have hundreds of millions of acres of untouched wilderness, and it's safe. But the thing is, no one understands that it's here. So it's a potential waiting to boom. The river itself, the Zab, was a brilliant shade of turquoise green. On either side, the mountains were yellow, covered in green scrub, and overhead, colorful birds swooped and played over the water. At a bend in the river, we came across a large family, sitting under the shade of a tree, enjoying a seriously impressive picnic of dolma. Those were the words broadcast by a BBC reporter who visited Kurdistan for the first time and was awestruck by what he found. He had heard that Iraqi Kurdistan was, as some call it, the other Iraq. He knew that no Americans or foreigners had been killed or injured there. He had seen the economic prosperity that companies from Europe and across the world had gone to the region to invest in there. Yet even with the expectations set high, he was still amazed at how peaceful it was, but also at how much fun it was. Now, I don't want to make this a bit of a stretch, but this description of Kurdistan sounds a lot like the descriptions of California 150 years ago, when those in other parts of America became aware of California as a destination for them. From Balboa to the Spanish missionaries to the 49ers of the Gold Rush to the Dust Bowl caravans, California has always been a place of new hope and a brighter future. We in Kurdistan like to think that we're replicating a bit of that in Iraq. Here is what Foreign Affairs magazine observed about Kurdistan. Landing at International Airport in Erbil, the capital of Kurdistan, one is immediately struck by the high level of economic activity that pervades all parts of the city. New highways, high rises, and construction cranes punctuate the city skyline, which now includes modern office towers and frames of luxury hotels. Traffic fills the streets, which bustle with pedestrians shopping for new cell phones and imported designer clothing. The city has large amusement parks, replete with roller coasters, bumper cars, and even a large Ferris wheel. A nearby go-kart racing facility, recently built by an American from Galveston, Texas, attracts a steady stream of young adventure seekers, while the bookish crowd can take refuge in a brand new multi-level public library. Sleymaniye and Duhok, respectively the second and third largest cities in Kurdistan, have seen similar flurries of economic development. Obviously, we are pleased that this progress can be seen by visitors coming to the Kurdistan region. Because after decades of oppression, our citizens deserve the chance to have their most dangerous moments come as a roller coaster comes racing down the track. We want these good times to stay and multiply, not just in Kurdistan, but throughout all of Iraq. Today, we are the strongest friend and ally that the United States has in our part of the Middle East. Our home is the place with the most progressive press law in the region, the place with a higher percentage of women in our legislature than most developed nations around the world. We are the place where Christians and other religious minorities fleeing persecution in other parts of the country come to and seek refuge there. We are the place where those seeking to invest, from some of our newest friends like the Koreans to our neighbors like Turkey, find our new economy vibrant, promising, and full of opportunity. And we're just outside your door. For example, we can make our way to San Francisco International Airport any day we choose and board United Flight 900, bound nonstop for Frankfurt, Germany. When you land in Germany, you can have a coffee and a pastry, more likely a beer. Then board the Lufthansa flight nonstop for Erbil, the capital of the Kurdistan region. By dinner time, you'll be in my homeland enjoying good kebabs and good tea. Referring to California, Horace Greeley famously was credited with saying, "Go west, young man." Today in Iraq, it is go north to Kurdistan. I tell you this because here in California, we know that image is often as important as reality. In the case of the Kurdistan region, both are accurate and intertwined. We think it is important to show the world that in a country that has become a byword for conflict, there is a region that has many, many positive impacts. To say that, we have timely issues to talk about today is an understatement. A crucial part of this discussion is about what makes up Iraq today and why it is important for the US to stay with us as we seek to secure hope that was given to us when your brave sons and daughters came from afar to liberate us from tyranny. President Obama has clearly stated that the US has turned the page in its relations and its engagement with Iraq. Turning the page is not the same as writing the next chapter. All of us in Kurdistan know how we want this story to end. What concerns us, though, is who the main characters are going to be, what those story elements are, if the story will unfold to the way that we want it to unfold. We have had many sorrowful chapters in our history, and much blood has been shed. Iraq remains a critically important country for the United States and the region. Iraq is a country that should have enormous impact on what happens outside of its borders. It is important because it can be a moderating factor in a turbulent part of the world. It can be a strong economic partner for the future. It can be a strong partner in countering terrorism. Furthermore, it can be a reliable source of natural resources, oil, gas, and in the future, renewable energy. It is also important because so much progress has been made over the last few years. Sectarian violence is down around the country. And while there continues to be political stalemates, and it's taken us 8 months to make the breakthrough to form our government, it is not too often that we talk about free and fair elections in the Middle East. It is not too often that we've had elections in the Middle East where the outcome has not been known before going into those elections, let alone an election where the results have been too close to call after the fact. Such a scenario during Saddam's tenure would have been inconceivable. So the US has done the hard part. It has liberated us from tyranny. And while your president has boldly said that the United States is turning the page vis-a-vis its engagement and with Iraq, I urge that the United States do not close the book when it's dealing with Iraq. You mustn't close the book because even though much progress has been made, there remains much more to do. Iraq's fledgling institutions need time to stand on their own feet. Its bureaucracy needs nurturing as it transforms from a centralized authoritarian system to a decentralized federal structure. Iraq's industries, for almost a century under the direct and dysfunctional stewardship of the state, needs to be gradually handed over to a more capable private sector. Iraq's outward focus must shift from what has been a militarized, hostile stance to a more tolerant, proactive, and moderating one. Instead of investing our natural resources into rearming our security services, we still need guidance on how to better invest in our people's future, into our education systems, and critical sectors such as agriculture and health. In all of these factors, Kurdistan is leading the way to a brighter future for all of Iraq. We have strengthened the unity of our people and are today working to make our government in Kurdistan, the Kurdistan Regional Government, more transparent, effective, and accountable. We are applying best practices and are working with renowned international consultants to streamline our bureaucracy, to eliminate graft, and institutionalize transparency. We realized that while we as a government had the best of intentions, we weren't necessarily best equipped to deal with the many challenges facing our society. especially in the delivery of services. 2 years ago, along with the rest of Iraq, the Kurdistan region only generated 2 hours of electricity per day. That was unacceptable. So our government teamed up with the private sector to rectify the situation. Today, with the leadership of our private sector, Kurdistan has over 20 hours of electricity a day, while the rest of the country is still at an unacceptable 2 to 3 hours. We know that there are 24 hours in a day, and we're working towards that fact. Furthermore, while the promise of our hydrocarbons serves as a sound insurance policy to ensure continued economic growth, we will not rest on our laurels and rely solely on our oil and gas to secure our economic future. My government has launched our region's most ambitious scholarship program, intended on sending thousands of students abroad to the world's best universities. No doubt some of the key universities, Stanford and others around this area, will be targets of those many Kurdish students. Moreover, we are fervent in our desire not to be solely an oil-dependent economy. Your experience in the United States, and in particular in California, has been instructive. That's why agriculture and tourism serve as such enormous potentials for us, and that's tourism and not terrorism. With our four clearly defined seasons and fertile lands, we are able to grow and produce almost anything. And with our untouched natural beauty and our mountains and our valleys, we could easily have our own natural parks that would attract tourists from the world over. But while we have a secure, prospering region, we are still part of Iraq. And the fate, our fate, is very much connected to Iraq's fate. Given the fledgling status of Iraq, its security, its institutions, and its politics, continued U.S. engagement and, more importantly, interest is vital. We've shown what we have been able to achieve with little strategic interventions from the United States. I am certain that with the right kind of engagement from the U.S., its government, and interest from its people, we can build a relationship that ensures that Iraq and the Kurdistan region fulfills its potential, and America is served with a reliable ally in a very unpredictable part of the world. Our challenge so far has been to build a government, to build a new government, to build a new nation, and we have all been through a very arduous 8 months since Iraq's historic elections in March. Up until recently, there looked to be a deadlock that was insurmountable. But over the last few days, there has been progress. The political forces have been able to convene. And I have to say, under the leadership of the Kurdish leaders of Iraq, it was the president of the Kurdistan region, President Masoud Barzani, who invited all of the Iraqi political forces to Kurdistan, all of the leaders of the various political blocs to Kurdistan, to a summit where we were able to discuss key issues such as power sharing, such as the top sovereign posts of the government, and platforms for the way forward. This meeting led to a breakthrough in talks, led to a breakthrough in negotiations, and today the Parliament of Iraq elected its new speaker, its new president, and its new prime minister. We still have a ways to go. We still have to form the cabinet. We still have to put together a platform for the way forward. We still have to institute those platforms and execute the constitution of the country and start to really build up a new society. But after 8 months of deadlock, it is great to finally have made some progress and start to repay the faith that's been shown in us by our friends across the world. While much of this was going on, there was a great expectation that the Kurds would stay out of the fray, that this is not our fight, that we would just stay up in the mountains and let the Arabs fight amongst themselves. But we didn't, because we knew that instability in Iraq will ultimately mean instability in Kurdistan. So we took this initiative. We called the leaders up to the Kurdistan region. And despite people's skepticism of our intentions, our leadership has yielded a breakthrough. We've also been clear in what we expect the next government of Iraq to be like, to work towards, and that is to try to build up a new identity. We are not Arabs, we are Kurds. So Iraq's identity must be reflective of Iraq's makeup. It has to represent all Iraqis, whether Arab or Kurd, whether Turkoman or Christian, whether secular or religious. And that is a challenge that we have undertaken to try as we build up this new country. We've introduced 19 points that we hope will become the platform for the next government of Iraq. In these 19 points that we hope will be continually discussed as the government is formed includes key issues such as power sharing, such as how to manage the natural resources of the country, such as how to resolve key issues such as resolving the issue of the disputed territories, implementing a key article of the Constitution, Article 140, which addresses the powerful issues such as Kirkuk and its future. So we've been very open about our intentions. We've been very open about what we as Kurds in Iraq wish to achieve, wish to see, and we're just hopeful that our interlocutors on the other side are as genuine as we are in this process. So I'm glad that you invited me here today, because we do need you. We need the United States, and we need you as Americans to remain interested in Iraq and in Kurdistan. Kurdistan today is successful in large part because of, and at times in spite of, U.S. policy. From President Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, which was the first time a world leader has staked out a position that Kurds deserve to, well, live first and then be equal, to the 91 no-fly zone that was established that gave us breathing room from Saddam's tyranny. It has been the United States who has had a pronounced impact on our security and our development. The Kurdistan region is bound to America like few others. Kurdish hopes for self-determination within a federal Iraq, after history of being victims of ethnic cleansing and mass slaughter, first became a precarious reality when President George H.W. Bush and then UK Prime Minister John Major, along with French President Mitterrand, instituted the no-fly zones over Iraq in 91. This came just 3 years after Saddam decimated the Kurdistan region through the Anfal campaign that led to the deaths of almost 200,000 people, the destruction of 4,500 villages, and the death of tens of thousands of Kurdish citizens at the hands of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. With American and allied protection in place, we began to build up our infrastructure. We started to hone our political vision. Today, we are a tangible success story in the United States. We are your natural friends and your allies there. But please be clear that I'm not here to discuss whether you think George W. Bush was right to invade Iraq or not, because that the fact is, he did, and because of that intervention, we are free from fear for the first time in more years than I could like to recall. This is a black and white decision for us. President Bush and President Obama have both said publicly that they believe that democracy can take hold in the Middle East. They are correct, and it is taking hold, and there are signs of democracy emerging in the Kurdistan region of Iraq. Agree or disagree with the decisions by the Bush administration, but agree that in Kurdistan there were people yearning to be free, to learn about democracy, and we are deeply grateful for your efforts, your toil, your sacrifice, the tears and blood and treasure spent on our behalf. There are no statues to American liberators in Kurdistan or streets named after your presidents. Perhaps those will come. What there is today in the eyes of every Kurd, in the bazaars of our large cities, in the tea shops of our villages, and along the trails of our mountains, there is the faces of gratitude for what you did for us. When we no longer hear the knock of the door, we give you thanks. When we no longer hear an aeroplane and worry if poison gas will fall upon us, we give you thanks. When we see investment, tourism, and diplomats from our neighbors and other nations come to Kurdistan, we give you thanks. There are very few times where you can see direct results of your efforts. We are that clear, unequivocal, direct result. It is crucial for Americans to realize that our success is your success, and that elusive light at the end of the tunnel is actually already shining in Iraqi Kurdistan. We don't want that light to go out, so we still need your support. And as you can see, the fruits of economic progress come in many forms. We are thrilled that the world is learning that our hard work is paying off, that we are steady in our march along the path to democracy. We are delighted that we in the Kurdistan region have done our part to help Iraq move forward. We are committed to that task, to making a federal, democratic Iraq a shining example for the rest of the world. Our story from the Kurdistan region has been uplifting. For much of the last 7 years, people throughout Iraq have come to visit us in the Kurdistan region because of what we've been able to achieve with your support. The U.S. military is leaving, but the stability that will define the United States' success in Iraq cannot and must not leave. That is why we were thrilled when the United States announced that they plan to open diplomatic consulates in Erbil in the Kurdistan region and also in Basra in the south. We see this decision as one in a series of steps by the United States to honor the pledges of President Obama and others for renewed and deepening support to Iraq and the Kurdistan region as part of its desire for ensuring stability in that part of the world. We do sometimes remain baffled that the United States has never embraced the success of the Kurdistan region. Such an embrace would go far to thwart any ideas of instability. As I noted, there remain tough internal issues that we Iraqis must work out: revenue sharing, hydrocarbons law, the future of disputed territories. Solving these issues is of great priority to our friends in the United States, but I can assure you that these are of much greater priority to us in the country. The Kurdistan region has been called many things, depending on whether the caller is a friend or a foe. But it is indeed one entity that, through fits and starts, has moved forward in fulfilling its pledges for democracy. It has not been easy, and it has certainly not always been neat and tidy. But it is happening, and the United States Congress and the Obama administration should reflect on just how important this is for Iraq and for the entire region. Thankfully, many recognize this imperative. In a column in August, Jim Hoagland, the highly respected foreign policy columnist for the Washington Post, urged the Obama administration to work with Kurdistan and to, quite bluntly, pay attention to our efforts to establish strong and direct security relations. "It is a good time, Mr. President, to get to know the Kurds and their ambitions," wrote Mr. Hoagland. We agree and hope that the White House and all of you also agree. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Talabani, for a wide-ranging and most informative talk, which I can see has been very well received by our audience. I have a number of questions, and many of them focus on one issue, where broadly, the Kurdish nation as opposed to the Kurdish regional government of Iraq. What do you see as the prospects for unity and what is generally considered the largest ethnic group that doesn't have a state of its own? How about your relations with Turkey and with the Turkish Kurds largely located in the southeast of that country? Are you supporting their aspirations at this point? How are you dealing with the problem of the PKK, the Kurdish terrorist group that is stationed or has its safe haven, so to speak, in the Kandil Mountain area? So there is this whole network of questions, and perhaps you might address them.
Well, there's quite a few there.
Yes.
I hope you guys have time and don't have dinner waiting for you at home, because I could spend a long time answering these issues. But I think one thing is right that you highlighted, and that is the Kurds are by far the largest community of people in the world that do not have their own country, that do not have a country to call their own. There are almost, some would say, even over 40 million Kurds alive today. And when you think that there are islands with populations of around 18 or 20,000 that have seats at the United Nations, it can at times become very difficult to take and accept. But that is an historical injustice that has befallen my people. It's a reality that we've had to live with and deal with, and different parts of Kurdistan have been able to manage their predicaments in better than other parts. But the Kurdish nation as a whole, Kurds, when they see a Kurd from Iraq, when he sees a Kurd from Turkey, does not distinguish the fact that they're a different ethnicity. They see their Kurdish brother or sister, regardless of whether it's an Iranian Kurd or a Turkish Kurd or a Syrian Kurd or an Iraqi Kurd. There is definitely a lot of kinship between Kurds from across the different countries, and there is a lot of interest in what's happening in the different countries. And I think a lot of the Kurds from Iran, from Turkey and Syria, look upon Iraqi Kurdistan with a lot of admiration, because we've been able to achieve a high degree of stability. We've been able to secure our identity as Kurds within Iraq. We've been able to secure our government, our parliament, our security services. The Kurdish flag is flying high, not only in San Francisco, but also in Iraqi Kurdistan. It's flying in Kurdistan. Kurdish cities, in Kurdish offices in Baghdad. And that is a sense of pride to many Kurds. But we in Iraqi Kurdistan are also mindful of the situation that Kurds in Turkey are in, the Kurds in Syria are in, the Kurds of Iran are in. And each Kurdish community has its own set of predicaments, has its own challenges, has its own pros and cons going for it. So I think what Kurds, regardless of whether they're in Iraq or Iran, they certainly support the equality for Kurds, for wherever they live in, whether they're refugees in Europe, whether they're Kurdish Americans assimilated here, or whether they're Kurds in Turkey, Syria, Iran, or Iraq. We deserve to be treated equally. We deserve to be treated on the same level, whether it's with Arabs in Iraq or whether it's with Turks in Turkey. And that is, I think, a uniform sentiment that spreads through Kurds all over the world. You know, we are challenging today to secure an identity in Iraq that has Kurds equal with Arabs, has Kurds equal with Turkmens. At the same time, we want to ensure that our identity is not higher or greater than other communities in Iraq. And that's why for us in Iraq, the constitution of Iraq is key. The constitution that is ratified by almost 11 million people, that has its own Bill of Rights, that sets this equality, that ensures that people should not be discriminated because of their ethnic or their sectarian identity. And unfortunately, reality is not always as rosy as the words that are written on constitutions or on legal documents. But that is the challenge that we're facing today. And it's also a challenge that I'm sure that we are certainly closely aware of our Kurdish brothers and sisters in other parts of the world. And all we can hope for is in this day and age, in this age of globalization, in this day when people are aware of exactly what's going on, even in a remote village, through whether it's through internet, whether it's through the news services, that countries will treat their own citizens better, that will give them equal rights, that will give them political, cultural, and economic rights. And in this day and age, that's all we can ask for.
Here's a provocative student, provocative question from a provocative student at Berkeley University. He writes, Kurdish support for PM Maliki, Prime Minister Maliki, in 2006 was based on his promise to implement Article 140 concerning the disputed internal boundaries. Now Maliki is again Prime Minister. Are you confident he will deliver on this issue or other elements of the Kurds' 19-point platform for the new government? And you might want to explain Article 140 a bit. And it's also, I think, if I may add, because the audience is probably not aware, there is hot news from overseas. There apparently, underline apparently, has been an agreement between Prime Minister Maliki and his chief rival for the prime minister spot, Iyad Alawi, on a power-sharing arrangement. And the outlines of this are not yet firm and clear. But one comment that is being made is that with Alawi and Maliki in apparent agreement, the Kurdish regional government, will lose much of their leverage in any in determining how Article 140 is implemented in dealing with oil legislation and so forth and so on. So I wonder if you could comment on that, sure, too.
Do they have provocative students at Berkeley?
Oh.
That surprises me. But it's a great question from this provocative student, because it is a key obstacle to whether or not Iraq succeeds as a state, whether or not Iraq moves forward as a state, whether or not Iraq can abide by its constitution, and whether the constitution is worth anything. More than the paper that it's written on. I think that, you know, to your point, Frank, there has been a tentative agreement, but I have to add that tentative agreement came as a direct result and engagement of the Kurdish leadership. That would not have happened had it not been for the Kurds brokering this agreement. It would not have happened if the Kurds had not brought the different sides together to come to Kurdistan, to come and discuss these issues. For us, it's important to have as many people under the tent as possible. We held up the train Bahrain to make sure that Iraqia was part of the political process. They've wisely chosen to be part of the political process. Prime Minister Maliki looks like he's going to stay on as Prime Minister. Could not have stayed on had it not been for Kurdish support. It looks like Iraqia will get the post of Speaker of Parliament. Would not have gotten that position of Speaker of Parliament had it not been for the support of the Kurds, and the Kurds will retain the presidency. So this is, an important development in Iraq. But I don't think it's a development that weakens the Kurdish hand. I think it's a development that strengthens the Kurdish hand, because it shows that nothing really can happen in Iraq if the Kurds are not central to it. No progress can be made on legislation in Iraq if the Kurds are not trying to push it through or bring the different factions together. So the Kurds are playing a very, I think, if I can be a little modest and say a wise role in looking, again, beyond our own Kurdish-centric interests, looking for a broader interest, but trying to solidify our strength and our clout, not only in Kurdistan, but at a national level in Baghdad. But to address the student's question, the implementation of Article 140 is going to be paramount to our continued support to Iraq, to this government in Iraq, and also to Prime Minister Maliki. We've had strong discussions with, in-depth discussions with the Prime Minister, with his team, with his negotiation team, and I think there is a genuine understanding that the Constitution is the Constitution, and we have to work with the Constitution that we have and not with the Constitution that we wished we had. This is the law of the land. This has to be implemented, and I think it's only in Iraq's best interest if this is implemented. Article 140 of the Constitution, just to educate anyone that's not really quite up to speed with what it is an article of the Constitution that addresses the disputed territories in Iraq. There are many parts of Iraq, and mainly along the Kurdish and Arab areas of Iraq, that are in dispute. They're in dispute because successive Iraqi governments had forcibly evicted Kurds from these areas. The most prominent area is Kirkuk, and it gets most attention because of the oil resources that Kirkuk has. But it's a huge swath of territories that goes all the way from Mosul province all the way down to the Diyala province, and it also encompasses the Kirkuk province. Saddam displaced nearly 500,000 people from these areas, and 80 or 90% of them were Kurds. There were also Turkmens, an ethnically Turkish group, that were displaced from some of these areas. This happened over several decades, so the impacts are quite pronounced. And the case is very complicated, because in some instances you've had people that have lived there, even though unlawfully, but they have lived there for close to 30 years. So when you're talking about normalizing this situation, as the Constitution of Iraq stipulates, and as this article in the Constitution stipulates, it breaks the problem down into three phases. Phase one is normalization, which is basically the resettlement and repatriation of those that had been forcibly evicted from their homes in a legal way through a judicial process. The second phase of this article discusses a census to be held, not just in Kirkuk and these disputed territories, but nationally, because Iraq hasn't had a census for many decades, not a reliable one anyway. And it is important to have a census, but it's also important to have one in the disputed territories, because it leads into the third phase of this article, which deals with a referendum in Kirkuk and the disputed territories. And the referendum is intended to ultimately give power back to the people of those disputed territories to choose how they want to be administered, whether they'll be administered by the Kurdistan Regional Government, whether they'll be administered by the federal government, or whether any other potential arrangements could be posed to the people of the region. What the Kurdish leadership has said all along and will continue to say is, look, it's not just for the Kurdish leadership to say Kirkuk has to be part of Kurdistan. We can say that all day long. It's also not for the federal government in Baghdad to make that determination. It has to be the people of that area that have to make that determination. But we cannot ignore the fact that genocide took place in this area, that people were forced out of their homes, people were killed, people were tortured and executed because of their identity. And while we have gone to great lengths to nullify all of the previous actions and injustices committed by the former regime in Iraq, We can't leave this dirty handiwork intact. We cannot justify or legitimize the genocide that took place in Kirkuk and elsewhere. Now, we're not asking to do to Arabs what had been done to Kurds. We want a legal process, and we've been very patient in this legal, in pursuing a legal solution to this problem. And that's why we had such hope that Article 140 would be the roadmap to solving this problem. We still believe it's the roadmap to solving this problem, and we feel that, this time, with our increased strength at a national level, with our increased strength in the national parliament, with our increased strength in the national government, but also regionally in Kurdistan, we'll be able to push this process through, have this constitution respected, upheld, implemented, and ultimately people in these disputed territories should have the right to choose how they live, who administers them, and how they should be secured. Maybe I'm an eternal optimist, but I feel that this time around we'll make enormous progress, because the future of Iraq hinges on a commitment to the Constitution and a commitment to these articles.
Thank you. A few questions on minority groups. One member of our audience wants to know more about the situation of the Assyrian Christians, and I suppose one might add the Chaldean Christians, in the KRG. And would you see any likelihood, any prospect for the establishment of a separate autonomous Christian region modeled like the KRG, perhaps in the Christian majority area in the Nineveh Plains bordering Kurdistan? Mm-hmm. Also, another member of our audience asks, is there a Jewish community in Kurdistan, and how important has it been historically? What is the state of current relations between the KRG and Israel?
The Assyrians, Chaldeans, and Syriacs of Iraq, the Christian community of Iraq, are having a very difficult time, regrettably. We all should have read the tragic attacks against the Christians in the church in Baghdad just over a week ago. And we have seen increased persecution of Christians by extreme Islamic groups in Iraq, groups that are tied and affiliated with Al-Qaeda. And it is regrettable because it's an ancient community. It's a community that has been there arguably as long as anyone else has been there. And they're being driven out by these extremists. Several hundred thousand have already left Iraq and are fleeing to whether it's to Michigan or other parts in Europe. And it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy that's befalling Iraq, and it's a tragedy that's befalling the Christian community in Iraq. I'm proud to say that the Kurdistan region, the leadership in Kurdistan, has had an open embrace to the Christians, not only to the Christians fleeing persecution in other parts of the country. Tens of thousands of Christian families have sought refuge in Kurdistan, in Erbil, in Sulaymaniyah, where they've been treated, I think, in even better way than the Kurds who have left Baghdad or the Kurds that have left Basra or Fallujah. But it's something that we feel is a priority because again, they are an indigenous community in Iraq, and then they have to be protected. We cannot lose this community. This community is vital for Iraq, for its future, for its economy, and for the pluralism that we're hoping to preserve and achieve in Iraq. There is also an indigenous Christian community in the Kurdistan region itself, in the capital of Kurdistan, in Erbil. There is a very thriving Christian community in Ankawa, for example, and it is part of the city which has the best restaurants, has the best nightlife, has the best, you see all of the international companies have their headquarters there. The U.S. consulate is in that area. And it's again, Kurds are proud of that. They don't feel threatened by it. And then I think there is a degree of tolerance in Kurdistan that we are very proud of, that the Kurdish people, it's a long-standing tradition that we are very proud of. We're hoping that measures could be taken to protect the Christian community outside of Kurdistan and to ensure that their rightful homes, whether it's in Nineveh, whether it's in Baghdad, or whether it's in Basra, can be protected and they can go back there. As far as calls for an autonomous Christian region or province, or I think, again, we have the Constitution of Iraq. The Constitution mandates federalism for Iraq. It states that provinces could form into regions with powers similar to Kurdistan. So if our Christian brothers and sisters wish to pursue this route, they can go through the steps that are outlined in the Constitution. I doubt that there would be any resistance from the Kurdish leadership. In fact, in the draft Constitution of the Kurdistan region, and it is still a draft, it hasn't been ratified by the Parliament of Kurdistan, it does say that if the people of the Christian community wishes to choose to live in an autonomous, predominantly Christian region, then if that's their choice, and if it's that's their democratic choice, and they pursue the legal and democratic route, who are we to oppose that? Why should we stop that? In fact, we fully support any community in Iraq fulfilling their democratic aspirations, as long as it's in adherence and in respect to the Constitution. The Kurds are also proud of the Jewish community that had historically lived in Kurdistan. Each of the major cities in Kurdistan have still a neighborhood called the Jewish Quarter or the Jewish Hill or the Jewish Block or Street, and it's something that most Kurds remember fondly. That unfortunately, that community left Kurdistan in the late 40s and this with the establishment of the State of Israel. And by all accounts, I think the largest Jewish Kurdish community outside of Israel may in fact be in Los Angeles, if I'm not mistaken. And there is in fact one of the preeminent authorities on the Aramaic language, which the Jews of Iraq and the Christians of Iraq incidentally speak. Yonah Sabar is at UCLA. It's one of the things that we're proud of is that Aramaic is still being taught in Kurdistan. It's one of the few places in the world where that language is still being taught. So while there aren't too many Jewish Kurds in Kurdistan today, people all have very fond memories of their Jewish neighbors and brothers and sisters. And there's a beautiful book actually written by Yonah Sabar's son, Ariel Sabar, called My Father's Paradise. And it outlines the story of his father and his grandfather and the pretty much the Jews of Kurdistan, and how when they left Kurdistan seeking what they thought would be an even better life in Israel, it turned out actually not to be that way. And the Kurdish Jews were mainly merchants. Let's say they weren't as sophisticated as the Baghdadi Jews or the Jews that came from other parts of the world. They didn't necessarily get welcomed into Israel as much, and they had a tough time assimilating in Israel, which is probably why they're all in Los Angeles right now.
There are several questions regarding Kurdish-American relations, and not only on the official but the informal level as well. I think one member of the audience is referring to the events of 1975, when the U.S. and the Shah of Iran jointly pulled the rug out from under Mustafa Barzani in his campaign against Iran, against Saddam, excuse me. And whether there's any lingering mistrust from that incident, whether Kurds may feel that after the U.S. invaded in 2003, we should have immediately pushed for an independent Kurdistan. And on top of all that, is there a difference, and if you could characterize it, describe it, between the attitude of the ordinary Kurd towards the Bush administration and now the Obama administration? Only easy question.
Yeah, sure. No, it's becoming a trend here. No doubt Kurds have felt betrayed by the United States throughout our history. In 1975, as you mentioned, when the Algiers Accord was agreed to, led to the ceasing of support to the Kurdish movement. That cease of support led to the collapse of the Kurdish movement because Saddam ultimately, the Iraqi regime, Saddam was the vice president at the time, crushed the uprising, and the rest is, as they say, history. And then we had the famous Kissinger moment after that, where then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger testifying before Congress when he was grilled on this issue, how could you, support this group and then let them get massacred the way they did, very infamously stated, covert work is not missionary work. Yes. And that has obviously left a lingering doubt and a lingering suspicion and a fear that the Kurds would be betrayed again. Unfortunately, it didn't stop there, because in 91, then President George H.W. Bush, after the Gulf War, called upon the Iraqi people to take matters into their own hands. We saw that as a cue for an uprising, so we blindly started an uprising and started to make significant advances against the Iraqi government at the time. There was a Shiite uprising in the south, and then suddenly there was cold feet, I think, by the American side. So on one hand, they called for the people to take matters into their own hands. At the same time, they agreed with the Iraqi authorities at the time to use their helicopters to crush the uprising. That crushing of the uprising led to millions of Kurds fleeing to the borders of Iran and Turkey, and it created an enormous humanitarian disaster that ultimately coined the phrase the CNN effect, because it was only when CNN and other outlets were able to cover millions of people freezing and some many, many thousands dying on the borders that it jolted the world into action, that it jolted the United Nations into action, that it hammer home a sense of guilt to the United States at the time. And with Britain and France, the no-fly zones and the safe haven was ultimately instituted. There's been positive development since then. So we would be foolish to think that all is rosy, that this kind of interest will never be put before friendship. But unfortunately, in this world of politics, interest is always put before friendship. And that is what terrifies us as Kurds, because we have come so far in such a short period of time. We've rebuilt the 4,500 villages that were destroyed. We've rebuilt a society that was devastated by Saddam's tyranny. We've started to make significant progress on the economic front, on the diplomatic front, on the governance front. We're starting to become a shining success story, and a success story that has significant U.S. fingerprints on it. And I can't point to too many U.S. foreign policy success stories in the Middle East right now. So Kurdistan is one of them. Embrace it, support it, build on it, be proud of it, because it is as much your success as it is our success. But that fear that now the U.S. is engaged in Yemen, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, that I sense it. I speak at World Affairs Councils across the country. I sense Iraq fatigue. You've been engaged in Iraq for too long. Your sons and daughters have been in harm's way in Iraq, and we don't want your sons and daughters to be in harm's way. We want them to return with their heads held high. But when we live in a very interesting neighborhood. We have some very interesting neighbors. And when you leave, when your forces leave, we are ultimately at the mercy of the region that we live in. And that while we've made significant gains and we've developed significant strengths since 91, that success will be jeopardized if there isn't a long-term commitment by the United States to remain engaged with us. And engagement doesn't mean having division upon division of your brave armed forces in Kurdistan. It means a commitment to a lasting friendship, a commitment to a strategic relationship that builds upon the success of the Kurdistan region, that helps us improve where we need to improve, on governance issues, on transparency issues, to help us to that extra level, because we can be a model for the rest of the country. We can serve as a model for other parts of the region. But that, again, can only happen with a long-term commitment from the United States, its government, and more importantly, its people.
Thank you. There are a couple of questions regarding the PKK. There are people who would like you to expand on your answer regarding the relationship between Turkey, Erbil, and Baghdad as to how one deals with the PKK. And member of our audience has mentioned that she has seen in the region around Dohuk PKK checkpoints that actually exist there, and nobody seems to be doing anything about them. So I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah, well, there is a long-term relationship between Turkey and the Kurdistan region. That relationship has not always been smooth. It's had some very rocky periods, and just 2008, there are 100,000 Turkish troops on our border, peering, waiting to invade. And there were several incursions in that year. There was no official recognition of the Kurdistan Regional Government. Many in Turkish political circles referred to the Kurdish leadership as just mere tribesmen. And the situation was very, very tense, so much so that the United States ultimately had to intervene. And thankfully they did, and they helped build some bridges, some dialogue that today has fostered into a much stronger, much more trustful relationship between the two entities. And whereas 2 years ago there was no relationship, today Turkish foreign minister comes to Kurdistan, is greeted by the president of the Kurdistan region. The president of the Kurdistan region visits Turkey on an official visit as president of the Kurdistan region. So these are things that are just, you know, a few years, mind-boggling. You would have never expected this a few years ago. And whereas when there has historically been discussion between the Iraqi Kurdish leadership and Turkey, it's always been centered on the PKK issue. The PKK, for anyone not familiar, is a rebel Kurdish, Turkish Kurdish group that is based in Turkey. Its head, you know, its main support base is in Turkey, but they do have a camp inside Iraqi Kurdistan on the border between Iraq, Iran, and Turkey. But they don't have checkpoints in Kurdistan. I mean, they control a mountainous area on the border, a very depopulated area with very small villages in that area, and they're able to navigate this very tough terrain between the Iraqi Kurdish and the Iraqi Kurdish, Iranian, and Turkish sides. And it's an unfortunate situation that for several decades there has been this armed conflict between Turkey and the PKK, and I think it has become more evident to many, including those in Turkey, that there is no military solution to this problem. That the solution to the PKK problem is ultimately a Turkish problem, and it has to do with a Kurdish problem inside Turkey, and that the solution to this problem can only be through diplomatic channels, through dialogue, through discussion, and through some sort of dialogue. And I think that's the key lesson here, is that the violence is not a solution to this problem. So that is what we're hoping for, that the dialogue that is ongoing between the Kurds in Turkey and the Turkish leadership, the Kurdish opening that is being discussed, the mere fact that there is this genuine debate within Turkish society about its Kurdish problem is, I think, a positive factor, because there's never been a Kurdish problem in Turkey historically. It's always been a Turkish problem. Mm-hmm. And the mere recognition of the fact that there is a Kurdish problem in Turkey, I think, is an enormous brave step that the people inside Turkey are undertaking, and I'm hopeful that it will lead to lasting peace in the region. And anything that we in Iraqi Kurdistan can do to help further stability in the region through without the use of force is very welcomed by us.
Thank you. A member of the audience wants to know about the situation of women in Iraqi Kurdistan. How free are they? How subject are they to traditional restraints, to Islamic strictures, and so forth? What is their situation in the job market? Questions like that. Questions that a feminist would ask.
Sure. We're all feminists these days.
You bet.
I think that the situation for women in Kurdistan is improving. It is not perfect. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that there are no problems in Kurdistan. I think a lot of it depends on which part of the Kurdistan region you go to. In the more urban areas, I think you'll see a greater level of equilibrium. But I think that in politics, the stature of women is improving. There are more women in the Kurdish parliament, like I stated, than in most parliaments around the world. And there is definitely a lively and very opinionated women's caucus in that parliament. They've been very effective at changing legislation. Kurdish women's civil society organizations have actually been been very effective in lobbying changes that have made heinous crimes such as honor killing illegal. So that is a criminal offense now in Kurdistan, and that, you know, it may seem surprising that this is something big, but the fact that it's actually gone through the legal process and it's been criminalized, it is a huge step for our society. Our society, our government, with civil society, with women's groups, are working to eradicate another archaic act, which is the act of female genital mutilation, which is something that is prevalent throughout conservative societies across from Africa through the Middle East into even parts of Asia. But it's something that even the Kurdish religious authorities have come out and said this is not a practice of Islam. So anyone doing this should not think they're doing this because of Islam. We think, again, we strongly supported the statements from the religious authorities, and as a government, we're trying to clamp down on this tragic act. And I think one of the reasons why occasionally you'll hear about these acts against women, more so in Kurdistan than other parts of the country, is because civil society in Kurdistan is strong enough to document and report these cases. And there are women's shelters where women feel comfortable in going to these shelters and talking about these crimes that are being committed against them. And for us, that is a symbol of hope, because where there is strong civil society, there's going to be strong pressure on government to change the necessary legislations and to enforce the legislations. And in many police stations now, there are women police officers and in senior ranks, and lieutenants and captains, where they are the ones that deal with women coming to the police stations and reporting abuses carried out against them. And I think we're getting a lot of assistance from international NGOs on these issues. And again, this is an issue that we want to be leaders on. We want to be a leading example on, and we want to apply the best practices of lessons learned in other parts of the world. So I have full confidence in Kurdish women who have been brave fighters when necessary, who have guarded the homes when their husbands have been at war, who have raised their families when necessary on their own, who have been breadwinners when necessary to stand up for themselves and ensure that their rights are protected. And there are many Kurdish male politicians that are championing their cause. And I'm very hopeful that we can continue to build a model society.
One last question. As a people without a state, what do you feel is the overall Kurdish sentiment toward the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and of course, as particularly regards the Palestinians, their desire for a state, and the status of Arabs who are within Israel, who are citizens of the state of Israel? What is the KRG's relationship with Israel in general?
Well, the KRG has no relations with Israel in general, but fortunately or unfortunately, we've had so many issues of our own to worry about. We haven't been able to give much time and much thought to the Arab-Israeli conflict, but that's been an issue that's been in our region for obviously for many decades, so we cannot truly avoid it. What we find interesting is the relative hypocrisy of the Arab world. In the 22 Arab states that have always supported the establishment of a Palestinian state, yet have never really been any supportive, let alone of the establishment of Kurdish state, but have never been advocates or public advocates of Kurdish rights in whether it's in Iraq or Turkey or Syria, except for, I think, Colonel Gaddafi, who's been very vocal about support for Kurds. It's been relative quiet among other leaders in that part of the world. So there has been, I would say, there's a bit of resentment from the average Kurdish citizen towards the attention and the rightful attention that the Palestinian cause has gotten around the world, and I felt, you know, why them and not us? Why, when there is an act of alleged persecution against the Palestinians, there is debates about it, the United Nations is uproar about it, but when 200,000 Kurds get massacred in the Anfal campaign, there is an eerie silence from the international community and from those that have, except from the human rights world. So I think that resentment is there, and Saddam fed into that resentment, because Saddam would fund the he was the leading champion of the Palestinian cause, and he would provide money to the families of Palestinian suicide bombers, and there would we'd see the images coming out from Palestine, where they would be showing, hanging up pictures of Saddam and dancing on the streets in support for Saddam, and that obviously doesn't go down well with Kurds in Kurdistan. So I think what we're just hopeful for is that, like all conflicts in our part of the world, that they can just be resolved equally and peacefully and equitably, and that communities can live in peace with one another. Kurds have no sensitivities or nothing against Israel. This is not, we feel that both sides have a right to exist. Both sides have a right to their statehoods, and both sides have a right to have their identities and their religions and their faiths and their identities respected, just like we do. And we're hopeful that, again, that our part of the world can become more tolerant than it is, because right now it is radicalizing. Right now it's a scary part of the world. And tolerance and moderation is diminishing, and radicalism and extremism is increasing. And takes me back to that, there is that island of stability in Kurdistan, and it's an island of stability that should be protected. And coming back to the U.S. Kurdish relations, it is something that, again, it surprises us that there isn't greater interest from the U.S. to try to secure, preserve, and build upon this, because, given the history, given the betrayals, and then obviously the balancing of those betrayals with your protection of the no-fly zones, the liberation of Saddam, there is great affection from Kurds towards the United States. It was the one place in Iraq where people welcomed the liberation, where you saw American flags on the streets. The image that many American officials at the time in the Bush administration wanted to see of people waving Iraqi and American flags happened. It happened. It happened in Kurdistan, but CNN wasn't there to cover it. CNN was in Fallujah covering the rockets being hurled at Americans. There is appreciation for the Bush administration's liberation of Iraq. There is appreciation for the Clinton administration's signing into law the Iraq Liberation Act. And in fact, President Talabani once bumped into both President Bush and President Clinton at the United Nations several years ago and thanked them both. He said, "Mr. President," to Clinton, "you're the one that signed the Iraq Liberation Act, and Mr. Bush, you implemented it. So thank you both." We're just hopeful that President Obama can maintain the level of interest in Iraq, and in particular in Kurdistan, and that the United States government as an institution, whether it's the Congress, whether it's the executive branch, whether it's the various other elements of the American foreign policy establishment, cannot be fearful of Kurdistan. We are something good that's happening in that part of the world, and that good should be embraced. We sometimes see that U.S. doesn't look out for its own interests. It's a little too worried and worrying about what this country may think, or what that country may think, or what the perceptions here or there would be. And at times we would like the United States to be just a little more forceful on its own interests. And its own interests, it has to be peace and stability in the region, has to be democracy and civil society and economic development, free market principles in that part of the world. And all of those elements, while not in total fruition in Kurdistan, are being built. We're moving towards a freer market society. We're moving towards democratic institutions. We're moving towards a strong civil society where there's freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, and freedom of ideas, when there is a vibrant political opposition group today in Kurdistan. All of these things that American policymakers had hoped Iraq would be by now is happening in Kurdistan. So embrace it, be proud of it, don't fear it, but support it and stand with us. And thank you for having me here. I've really enjoyed the discussion. I hope to be back here again.
Well, we are out of time, unfortunately. And so on behalf of the World Affairs Council, I would like to thank Kubar Talabani for providing us with his thoughts and insights.
Thank you
so much.
Frank, and if I could just give this book as a small gift of our appreciation to the World Affairs Council.
Splendid. Oh, excellent.
This is a pictorial history of Kurdistan.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Oh, those are fantastic pictures. I'll have to come down and read it. Anyway, if there are any Marin natives here, I'd love to talk to them. I'm chair of the Marin chapter. And any Turks, I would like to speak to them as well, because Turkey is my specialty. I sense there is a Turk in the audience.